So, last time, we kind of finished up talking about Wi-Fi topics. So you mentioned this idea of multipath, that one issue that, to a first approximation, is not good for wireless, is that our radio signals can get to our destination in multiple ways, and when they do, well, we get multiple copies of the signals that are overlaid, and that can make the signals harder to interpret, or sometimes easier to interpret, depending on how exactly that matches up at a sort of very fine-grained level. And we talked about this kind of trick for actually taking advantage of having kind of multiple ways for our signals to go, which was something we could do if we had multiple antennas, multiple transmitters and receivers. And that's that we can say, well, hopefully these kind of two antennas and receivers, you know, like kind of ideally, if we had two sender and transmitters and two receivers, we just send two separate signals. Of course, that doesn't work if they're on the same frequency, but what we can do instead is we can still send two separate signals, but we can kind of figure out how to decouple them when we receive the combinations, because we'll get different combinations of the two signals at our multiple receivers. And this idea is sometimes called MIMO, multiple input, multiple output, and is kind of one of the more recent innovations that gives Wi-Fi kind of the opportunity, when you have a good signal, to have very high transfer rates, because we can kind of get more out of the same amount of actual kind of frequency bandwidth by taking advantage of multiple receivers. And when we can't get more bandwidth out of it, having multiple receivers gives us kind of better options, because, you know, if we have this interference that's kind of very location dependent, if we have two receivers, hopefully one of them won't be in that dead spot. Then we talk about kind of the organization of Wi-Fi networks. And Wi-Fi supports this kind of ad hoc mode where every node just talks to every other node directly, but this is almost always not what we do. Almost always we have a base station. In Wi-Fi parlance, this is called an access point. And everything goes through the base station. A wireless node in the typical mode, which was called infrastructure mode, registers with an access point. And once it's associated, all its traffic is going through that local access point. And if we have a big Wi-Fi network, like if we think of like EduRoam at UVA, we're going to want to have lots of access points. And so to support that, we're going to have some kind of back-end network connecting the access points. And there's flexibility about how you do this. So like probably ideally for performance, you'd have like a wired gigabit or 10 gigabit Ethernet network between them. But maybe that's not practical to wire up, so you might actually use wireless links between the access points otherwise. But regardless, the access points need to coordinate information, like if I get a packet from the internet, what access point needs to send it to the actual node that needs it? So they need to coordinate some sort of thing like a neighbor table that, you know, says, you know, this IP address goes to this MAC address, and also where is this MAC address on the network? And actually kind of Wi-Fi networks are trying to look like, if it's one Wi-Fi network, you know, typically like one big layer two, as in switched network. So we'll have to do kind of our usual switching MAC learning type stuff within one of those networks. Now we might divide up a network with the same name into multiple, as they're called, broadcast domains, but to a first approximation, the simplest idea is that it's one big network where we can ask to contact a machine with its MAC address, and the APs need to know how to find it. And because we have this kind of forwarding idea on Wi-Fi, we have these Wi-Fi frames actually contain these four addresses, because we can be sending our Wi-Fi packets, you know, multiple hops, you know, typically what will happen is we'll have it be sent between two access points on its way to the end node. And to support this, we need to have two different notions of source and destination. We need to know where, who should be receiving this right now, and where is it ultimately getting to. And these all need to be MAC addresses, because this is something where it's a local network. We're supposed to use MAC addresses on our link layer local network, not IP addresses. Then we talked about some options that aren't used much in Wi-Fi. So we talked about this idea of mesh networks, which is kind of the idea behind like how one of these distribution networks that works over Wi-Fi would work. And people have built these just for the sake of having kind of a self-organized Wi-Fi network for like municipal use. And the question is, how do you do routing there? And the answer is, well, we learned how to do routing with like link state protocols or distance vector protocols. You can apply those same ideas to wireless. The only tricky thing is that our notion of a link is not so obvious. You need to like see who is in radio range of me and kind of define your links dynamically, and they'll kind of get cut out when your reception goes bad, like if you're outdoors, like from weather, for example. Then we talked about one of the kind of fundamental problems with wireless networks, which is that unlike our wired networks, reception of signals is not symmetric. Not transitive. You know, that we can interfere with each other in a way that is not possible in the wired domain. And the biggest example of this problem was the hidden node issue, where two nodes A and B cannot hear each other's transmission, but when they're transmitting to some other node, they interfere with each other. And we had one mitigation for this, which was this request to send, clear to send idea. And we learned that, you know, that mitigates this problem. Maybe it's too paranoid in cases where we don't interfere with transmissions. And then we started talking about what would be our last topic in wireless, which was this idea that instead of having this notion that nodes kind of transmit whenever the channel seems to be free, we can have some central coordinator. And in Wi-Fi, the obvious central coordinator would be the access point. So Wi-Fi has this polling mode where the access point decides when people transmit, you know, and therefore, you know, ideally this gets much better utilization of the channel. As for why isn't this used in practice, like one reason is probably that it's not the best for latency, because we have to wait till a specific node is pulled. And the way the polling mode works is that the access point asks specific nodes for data at this point in time. And for nodes it's not asking explicitly, it gives these periods where you can transmit normally that are explicit. Another reason why it's probably not very popular is that typically we have multiple access points in range. Like if I tried to have, you know, if I was living in a, back in the apartment I used to live in, and I had my router in polling mode, you know, the notion of having it in polling mode is that it controls who uses the channel. But all my neighbors in my apartment also have Wi-Fi access points that are also using the channel regardless of what my router says. And so this doesn't work in many real scenarios, because lots of people use the same frequencies for other things. So questions on these things we covered last time, where we talked about sort of more practical central planning approaches. Okay, so we're gonna look at that polling idea, but we're gonna do a better version of it, and this is what most cellular networks do. So in cellular networks, they have much tighter control over who uses the frequency, because it's not unlicensed spectrum, it's licensed, or only specific people, specific companies are supposed to use it. And also, they don't just have one channel like we do in Wi-Fi, where we typically kind of assume we can only listen to one frequency at a time. They're gonna have sort of a lot of available channels. and they're going to have some central planning that divides up the when you transmit and what channels you transmit on. And the common way of doing this is that periodically, like every millisecond or something like that, the sort of base station, which is a cell tower in the cellular case, is going to send out kind of a plan for the next millisecond. And our textbook has this diagram where the plan, well, we're going to have a whole bunch of frequencies we can use, and this plan over time. And we're going to tell each device, here are the times and frequencies you transmit on. And we're going to do this every millisecond. And the base station is basically going to plan when everyone transmits. And the idea of doing this and why the cellular networks like it so much better than the Wi-Fi strategy is that this can get near perfect utilization of the channel, because we can fill almost all these slots, especially if the traffic we're worried about is like voice transmission, where voice has a very predictable bandwidth, you know how many slots you need in advance. You know, that's very easy. It's a little trickier with network stuff, but we're doing this at a millisecond granularity, so we can probably guess, you know, when they might have stuff to transmit. And something they do to make this work is that they choose a way of encoding their messages such that they can have very they can have lots of subchannels here, and they're encoded in a way where they tend not to interfere. So something we didn't talk about is when you have two transmissions on a similar frequency, if they're too close, they tend to interfere. They like use an encoding that lets them push how much you can do that. And that's partly so they have more flexibility here. And so with this design, each base station is managing, you know, putting this together, and is also sort of tracking, you know, all the user devices and how much bandwidth it thinks they need and so on. And one issue with this is like, how do we deal with if there's two cell towers in range? And the answer is that we're going to coordinate that centrally, and we're going to have them use different frequencies at different times or different times. And so that's how we're going to avoid that issue. And so the base stations will send out these things, and when a device needs to switch base stations, the base stations and the infrastructure in the cellular sort of central office will coordinate that handoff. So, when, you know, rather than it being like Wi-Fi where we just switch from one place to another, you know, we're going to do it centrally. And we're going to track, you know, when are you getting out of range of one base station and getting in range of another. Some questions about this kind of central scheduling idea? So one thing that makes this maybe a little tricky is that we have these very small scheduling periods of 0.1 or 1 millisecond. If you remember, you know, what I said about propagation delay, you're like, our propagation delay is going to be in the microseconds. And for cellular networks, often our cell tower will be like miles away. So the propagation delay will be significant. And if we're trying to schedule these tiny bits of time, you might wonder, how does that work, you know, like that? And one thing we could do is we could make all the time windows large enough to like account for the propagation delay, meaning we'll have some dead time at the beginning and end, which we will do to prevent interference. But we're going to do a bit better than that. So typically, the schedule of slots will also tell each device a time delay for their transmission, which will be based on an estimate of the propagation delay between the node and the base station. And that allows the base station, you know, to compensate for this propagation delay and prevent, have them not interfere, even though they're transmitting tight in time, and even though they're not doing set carrier sense or anything like that. So one thing that this doesn't handle very well is, like, what if I go somewhere, my cell phone's off, and I turn it on? My cell phone's not going to have an entry in this table here. So we need some way of handling new devices or devices that suddenly need bandwidth that they don't have already. And the mechanism for this is going to be actually similar to what happens in the Wi-Fi polling mode, is that we'll have these designated random access channels. And we'll have times where we do something Wi-Fi-like that's interleaved somehow with these scheduled transmissions. So we'll tell the devices, hey, if you want to just try transmitting, this is when you do it, and we'll use Wi-Fi-like sort of contention management for that, with like retransmission and back off. And this is how we'll handle things like a new device is registering, you know, that previously wasn't on the schedule of transmissions. So we talked about implementing our central scheduling idea. So let's think, which of these things, what do we handle better in these cases? I'll do, I'll take a question or So let's start with, let's start with what I have labeled as A, which you think better in practice is likely to utilize the available bandwidth? Who thinks central scheduling? Who thinks carrier sense? Who thinks it depends? So we have a pretty good, I guess because I hinted at it, that central scheduling probably does this. So I'd say the caveat here is, right, that we're assuming that the device will actually use, assigned bandwidth. So if we assure that, the central scheduling does much better because we have this loss with carrier sense where we're going to inevitably, with enough devices, get collisions. But we also have this loss in this case where we can only assign slots of specific sizes, and we're going to kind of reserve bandwidth in advance, and either we kind of increase our latency by making devices request bandwidth before they transmit, or we sort of have wasted bandwidth that the devices get but don't use. And whether that's a problem probably depends on what sort of transmissions we're doing. For something like phone calls, it's probably not an issue, because I know if we have a phone call that the encoded audio signal takes up so much bandwidth every time unit, that's easy. If we're talking about like browsing the web, maybe that doesn't work so well. But generally, central scheduling at least has the potential to use a lot bandwidth a lot better because of that planning, at probably the cost of some latency when we want to request new bandwidth, or wasted bandwidth if we don't want to avoid that latency. How about B? Who thinks central scheduling handles this case better? Thinks carrier sense does? Yeah, and I would say this is a case where, issue carrier sense probably works better. So with central scheduling, we don't know about the we have two nodes that aren't coordinating with each other. So if we have base station A and base station B that are using the same frequency, that just is not going to work out very well. that we're going to have devices in here that are transmitting, that both receive. And because we're making these plans like a millisecond in advance, yeah, a millisecond's not time, but, you know, we're going to make conflicting plans, and we're going to have committed to those plans and committed to causing interference when we do this. Now, conceptually, you know, if we're really smart, we can come up with those central schedules in a way that avoids interference, and maybe we can kind of figure that out, but that seems a lot harder because we are doing our planning at this higher time granularity. So remember, with Wi-Fi, like we were doing carrier sense in kind of the microsecond level. Here we're doing our planning at the millisecond level. That's just going to limit what we can do, what we can adapt to. Even though, yes, you know, one of the things that apparently is like kind of the secret sauce for a lot of wireless cellular carriers is, you know, making this schedule like adapt to, like, we have bad radio reception on some frequencies and things like that. It's not that they can't deal with things like interference and don't deal with things like interference. It's just that their mechanism for doing that maybe can't adapt as quickly. Okay, how about communication between two nearby nodes? Who thinks central scheduling is better? Thinks carrier sense is better? Who thinks it depends? Okay, so most people think carrier sense is better, and what's the argument for that? Yeah.
Because in central, for central scheduling, two nearby nodes need to take the long route to each central station.
Okay, so your argument is with central scheduling, we only talked about supporting going to the base station and back. And we could potentially go directly with not with the carrier sense idea. So I think that's a good argument, though you'll observe that Wi-Fi in infrastructure mode also does this. It also goes back to the central station. So even though in theory it supports the better idea, it doesn't do it the way you're typically using Wi-Fi. But yeah, that's a reasonable argument. I think conceptually we could have the central schedule like allow you to transmit to someone else, but that's not something that cellular networks typically care about supporting. Yeah. So I would say, like, my kind of view is that, you know, that this is kind of a wash, but probably, like, the central scheduling techniques really are designed to support just everyone communicates to one place. But you can use the same idea to schedule transmissions between two nodes. You could have someone do it centrally. It just seems maybe unnecessary if they're close to each other. They may have a better way of coordinating that, especially since they, you know, should need like less power to do that and so on. Okay. So, and that's where I finish up talking about wireless. So topic, any questions on anything wireless before we go on to our next topic? Okay, so my sort of tentative list for the rest of the semester is that we're going to talk a bit about firewalls and then encapsulation, and I'm guessing that'll take me up to where I have exam review. If not, I'll talk a little about peer-to-peer, but probably those are the remaining topics for the semester. So we'll talk about firewalls, and firewalls, we're going to do packet filtering. And to talk about firewalls, it's worth kind of talking about what are use cases we have for packet filtering. So some examples might be that if we have packets with a false source address, so if someone's sending packets to my networks with a source address claiming it's from my network, and I know it's not because it's coming from outside, I want to filter those out. If someone is trying to access servers that aren't on the list of servers I allow people outside the network to access, I want to filter those out. And if there's some network I know always is trying to hack into my systems, I might want to just block all their connections, all their traffic. And if there's some sensitive private network, like at a company, I might want to make sure that there's no software running on sending things out that I haven't like approved. So like maybe I only want like connections to websites from and other things like that. I don't want a random, you know, game server running on that private network. So there's all these sorts of administrative reasons where we're going to want to filter out packets. And these are types of filters that we don't have tools for yet. We have routing tables that do something similar, but routing tables don't match on source addresses. They can match on like destination servers, but they're not, they're very coarse grained. They like either make the server reachable or not reachable. They're not more selective than that. So we're going to want a tool that lets us sort of select on more things than just what destination address goes where. And we'll typically, the name for a packet filter will be a firewall, especially at least when the filtering is focused on security. And there's kind of a bunch of dimensions in what we do with firewalls. So one question is, where do you put a firewall? Where do we put a packet filter? And probably the most common idea is that we'll have our, internet, and we'll have our firewall. And the firewall will somehow be in between us and the, and our private network. That's probably the most common thing. It will be at the edges of the network. And we could have this be part of what our router does, or maybe we'll have a separate box. So we'll have like a router here and a router here and some box in between that does packet filtering. We can also do it elsewhere. So for example, we could have a firewall running in the OS of an end host. So we can do packet filtering at the last possible place, just before the end host actually processes the packets. Or just before the end host sends the packets. Because something that's maybe doesn't come up right here is that the filtering, can be in both directions. And often will be in both directions. And that's also true for firewalls running. So the other big decision, big design decision in firewalls is how much information do we track? So kind of the simplest way to build firewalls is that we look at a packet, we decide if it goes, and we move on. But as we'll see, this is going to limit our flexibility a lot. There's things we can't do with that design of a firewall. So instead, you might want to have what's called a stateful firewall, where I'll have some state. So I'll look at a packet and I'll look at my notes about things I've seen recently and use that to decide how I handle that packet and maybe update my notes. So we'll have some state, some notes about recent things that have happened. We'll see an example of the form this could take, and we'll use that for filtering. And a stateless firewall has the advantage that, this is a way faster, way easier to build firewall than a stateful one. But there are just things we cannot do with a stateless firewall, including things that are very common goals for a firewall, very common policies people want to implement that just won't be possible with a stateless firewall. And so we have kind of our the classic corporate firewall idea, the diagram from the textbook, is going to filter our traffic, and we want it to be selective because, we don't just want to deny all traffic because, if we have some traffic we want to actually allow and some we maybe don't. And In this kind of scenario, this is probably by far the most common type of firewall deployment, is this kind of scenario where we have some company or organization network and a firewall between it and the external network. And a way we can kind of think of this is that we'll divide up our network into zones. And even more different firewall policies typically have this notion that we're going to think of our network as being divided up into these different zones, and we'll have different policy about how data can move between different zones. And the most common way this works is we'll have an internal network, which usually will allow to send things to the outside, but we don't want to receive unsolicited traffic from elsewhere. We don't want anyone connecting to our internal network, which we haven't carefully audited is okay. And this would be like in a company where like our typical laptops and desktops would live. We'll also often have what's known as a DMZ, or demilitarized zone, because the people in security often have a very military terminology, which maybe isn't healthy, but that's how the terminology works. But this is a zone that's not protected from external networks, but isn't an external network. And it will have access to the internal network, so we're not going to filter things between it and the internal network. This is where we have externally accessible servers. So if we had a web server that needed to contact things on the internal network, we put it in this DMZ zone. The web server needs to be externally accessible. It has a good reason it needs to access things on the internal network. You know, that maybe back the stuff that's on the website. So it might be in this DMZ. And we'll have the external network, which is where we'll put things that are on the internet or conceptually on the internet. Maybe we'll run some services that we want to be, you know, as if they're isolated completely from our network. We might have them be in the same, have the same policies as stuff that's on the rest of the internet. And so typically the firewall's policies will be built with some notion of zones like this. The zones might be different in a different organization, but basically we're trying to enforce rules about what can be sent between each of these different zones that are different. So questions about these zones so far? So the way we'll actually implement the firewalls and the way that typically we'll have system administrators configure the firewalls is that they'll set up rules. And this will kind of look similar to a routing table, but rather than our rules being this range of destination IP addresses goes here, they'll have a much more complex way we can match packets. And to think about this, let's think about some, here are some ideas for policies you might want to have in a firewall. What parts of packets do we need to actually implement these policies? Or I'm saying these are packets we want to match. The idea is the policy would be allow or disallow these specific types of packets. So let's start with our DNS queries to a recursive DNS server that we run, presumably, from external servers. What do we need to figure out if a packet falls in this class?
Yeah. We need like the destination IP.
Okay, so we need a destination IP. Okay, what other fields? And port, which port number? Destination source?
I guess destination port.
Destination port. Anything else? Yeah.
Source IP?
What, the source IP? Yeah. So we need the source IP to do the external server part. And I guess destination port, like this also matters, TCP or UDP. Okay, and how about packets with a source address that does not match the network they're from? I should say. What information do we need for that? This should be a good beat. So I'd say we need the source address, and we also need to know sort of network the network received on. And from known malicious networks, hopefully a source address. How about our entry here? So connecting to outside TCP server is not an allow. From outside to TCP server is not an allow list. What do we need to implement that policy? What information from packets? I would say this is the first tricky one. So let's start with, through some obvious fields, we need to figure out, is this packet connecting to a TCP server that's not on this list of allowed TCP servers from outside? What are some fields we need to look at to do this filtering? Yeah.
Protocol.
So we need to know the protocol, yeah. We need to determine it's TCP, good. Other fields? Yeah.
Service address.
So the destination address, and do we want IP, port, something else? What type of address? MAC? What address are we using?
I think it would be IP instead of MAC.
Okay, IP. And I would say we also want the port. What else do we need? Anything else, or are we all good? Is that all we need from the packet? Like, obviously we need the allow lists, but what do we need from the packet besides the protocol, destination IP, and port? And this is not a trick question. There is something else we need. So when we have a TCP packet, right, if we think of going from A to B, right, we have the connecting set up, and then we're sending data. And this happens in both directions. So if we see a TCP packet with a particular destination IP address and port, that doesn't tell us it's a connection to a TCP server. It could be one of those things inside connecting to the outside and receiving data. So we also are going to need the TCP flags to know whether this is the packet that starts a connection, is supposed to start, make a new connection or not. So I promise, yes, it got a little trickier here. Because we need to distinguish between we're just sending data on an existing connection and this is a new connection. Because we want to prevent connecting, we didn't want to prevent everyone from using TCP servers outside the network from inside. And if we just filter on the destination, we're going to not be able to get any responses back from other TCP servers. Yeah. So this is from outside is our rule.
Yeah.
So the common way, so what would be point of line? So a way you might have this is I'm running a TCP server on one machine here, but I also on the same network have people with their laptops who are trying to use the web. right? If we just don't allow connections, TCP connections at all, they can't use the web from inside the network to outside and receive a web page. Because the packets they're receiving in the web page are going to have a destination address and port of their laptop, which is not a place that we're allowing TCP servers to run, but this is not a TCP server, this is a web browser. So we want to distinguish between those two cases. If, you know, because if you were a sysadmin and I told you, please block people from running TCP servers and you made all my web browsers not work, I'd probably be very disappointed. Does that make sense? So the other thing we need here actually is the source address, source IP, because we want to do the from outside part. So the TCP flag, source IP. So we need to match on a whole bunch of stuff to make this happen. Okay, how about our last entry here? So connecting from inside using services that aren't on an allow list. So we've been asked to implement a policy where we only allow people to use HTTP and HTTPS and nothing else. How do we do that with? What parts of the packet do we need to look at? Yeah.
I guess the destination port.
So destination port. Okay, anything else we want to look at? Yeah. The source IP. Yeah, we want to like check if it's from inside. Anything else? Yeah.
Protocol.
So what do you mean by protocol?
Like whatever, like HTTP or whatever it is.
So that's an interesting question. If we think about our packets, so if we remember our packet format, we have like an IP header, right? With a source, destination, and a protocol, which is typically TCP, UDP. Then if we have TCP, which would be the common case, then we have a TCP header with a source port and a destination port. And there could be other ones. So are we talking about this protocol field? I agree we need that. That's a good thing to have. Is that what you're talking about, or do we want something else? Okay, so why do you want something else? Like, what's insufficient about this?
Well, I meant like checking for whatever the not allowed service was.
I like this idea. Like, what are we going to check for? We think about our packet structure.
Data.
It would be in the TCP data. Yeah. So this is an ugly thing here, that. If we want to implement this rule, you had this idea that, quite sensibly, that we're going to assume that, oh, if it uses HTTP, it uses a particular port number. And yeah, that's typically the case, but you know from the web server assignment that you can absolutely run HTTP on a different port. And the other way around, we can absolutely run, say, SSH on the HTTP port number. So this like only kind of works. And we need to kind of guess from the data if we wanted to do this. And I would argue we can't really do this. Like we can do an approximation of it. And many companies will do this approximation where they'll match on the port number and hope that's good enough. But I can run an SSH server on port 80 or port 443. I can run an HTTP server on port 6000. And we're not going to actually implement the policy I wrote down for either of those cases. Also, if we're doing this filtering, HTTP, we can look at the data and figure out it's HTTP. For something encrypted, this is a lot harder. Right, we probably can't do that, or we shouldn't do that. So this is a case where we get in trouble that, like, maybe these policies don't really work out. And another observation you might have here is that when we talk about what to filter there, we were looking at the destination port number to determine what type of packet it was. You know, we could be sending things that aren't DNS queries there. But in this case, we didn't care because presumably our recursive DNS server is just going to reject those because we know how it's configured. But if we were talking about some random DNS server, well, just because it's port 53 doesn't mean it's actually DNS. Yeah. Because an outside server could connect from port 80. So usually when we connect to as a client, right, we allow the OS to assign our port number, right? But we don't have to do that. So your proposal is that I'm going to have a packet that's connecting to an internal, that's accessing. So you want to look at the destination port for what purpose? So your goal is that we're going to allow a connection to from inside to, you know, some random website 3. So inside some IP, some port, right? And then we're going to get data back. And your proposal is that we're going to identify this based on this here, based on the IP endpoint. Is that what you're saying? Like, we're going to tell it's a web browser. Is that your proposal? Just want to make sure I understand what you're proposing before I talk about, like, why I think, like, it's not 100% problematic. We can make it work in some cases, but it's, I think, probably not practical.
Wait, so you're saying the sending back part wouldn't be possible if we don't check the TCP flex?
So the issue here is that something we could do is we could allow external traffic from port 443, right? But the problem is that, like, even though my typical case is my web browser connects there and gets a response back from that port, what could happen is that I could have port 44, someone at some, you know, evil.com port 443 connect to my inside server. Unsolicited, right? There's no web browser running there, it just connects there. And it can connect from port 443 because they can choose whatever port number they want on evil.com. The people running evil.com can choose whatever port number they want to connect from. So we can't look at the port number in isolation and see that this is a TCP packet and know, oh, this must be for a web browser. Does that make sense? We could do something where, like, we have a list of all the websites I know about, and allow port 443 from them. We could do something like that, but I think, you know, this means that now you have to make a list of all the websites you want to allow, and if it's not on the list, it's not going to work.
Yeah, that's why I thought that
allow list was. That's what you thought the allow list was. So when I talked about an allow list, this was an allow list for the TCP servers we want to allow connections to from outside. But I don't have the same rule for from inside to TCP servers, right? I don't care about that case. Does that answer your question? Clarify things? Because I think this is a common policy that I'm running a corporate network. I want to allow certain servers to run inside the network, but I don't want to get complaints from companies, people with their laptops, that this application doesn't work. And that application might need to make outgoing connections to all sorts of random stuff. Does that clarify what I'm looking for? Yeah, so to handle this, we want to check for connection-making packets versus other ones. Okay, so we talked about kind of the general mechanics of, you know, looking at packets. Let's look at a concrete example, and I'm going to show you how rules are written for NF tables, which is one of the three different packet filtering interfaces in Linux. Why are there three different ones? Well, yeah, history. And the way NF tables work is that we have these chains of rules that are applied in order, and there's chains for different phases of packet processing. So there's one called pre-routing, one for input or forwarding, depending on whether it's received or being forwarded, where our machine's a router. One for output, for when it's being sent from a local program. One for post-route, which is after all those steps. And here's an example of some NFT rules. We start here. So here, when I get packets in, and I'm doing normal input, I guess I probably should make this, you know, we might want to do this be forward instead of in. Or I guess probably this would be better as pre-routing. I should do pre-routing instead. But we have a filter hook that acts at a particular step. We could do input or pre-routing or forward. And I have this first rule, which says that if it comes from the interface LO, which is the local host interface, the kind of virtual loopback interface, accept the packet. Otherwise, if it comes from the interface ethext, the external one, apply this chain of external input rules. And we have a rule here that says, oh, if the IPv6 address is in this set here, drop the packet. If the source address is here, IPv4 source address is in this set, drop the packet. This is probably, I'm filtering out spoof source addresses from outside my network that are in my network. If it's for one of these destination ports, accept it, otherwise drop it. This is probably going to make all my TCP connections not work. And similarly, from inside, like I have some specific rules. So we can see how we can write rules. Are these rules useful? Well, I'm dropping almost all packets except for these specific TCP connections, and that's it. So I'm being very paranoid with these rules. But you can see we have these sequences of rules. We're matching packet flags. And as a system administrator, I can tweak these to be as strict or not strict as I want. So questions on my kind of naive filter rules here? So we have these kind of chains of rules applied in order. And this is, so far, using stateless rules. And to talk about the limitation of stateless rules, let's think about doing, let's say we're administering the 3FFF network, and I want to allow connections from a particular machine to outside sources and drop all other traffic. I don't want any other packets getting in. I'm worried that someone's going to use this to compromise my systems inside. So let's say I want to implement this. Here's a broken rule. Why does this not work? What's going to happen? Why is this rule bad? assume we're going to put this in a place where it runs every time you forward packets in the router. What's going to break with this rule? Yeah.
So maybe responses coming back.
Yeah, so this allows, if we think of our TCP, this allows to the external server, but when the external server sends stuff back, its source address doesn't match, it's going to get dropped. So this doesn't work. So let's do a better version of that. So here, I've done a tricky rule here where externally, TCP, I check the flags and see if it's a SYN. Because if we remember our TCP handshake, we send a SYN to request connection, we get a SYN plus ACK, and then an ACK. And then we start sending data. So I check for a SYN. Notice that I had to do this very careful thing of checking for a SYN without and not certain other flags, but not all of them, because there's some other bits in the flags that don't change whether it's a SYN, like the flags for ECN negotiation. So any complaints about this filtering design? And also, I realized, oh, I was filtering out ICMP error messages that might be nice to get, so I allowed this. So an observation you might have is that I'm only filtering out the connection attempts. So if someone just sends me a bunch of TCP packets that aren't part of a connection, they'll get to the sort destination machine. So we aren't really implementing the rule of filter out everything but things that are part of the TCP connections I made. We're not doing that. We're preventing incoming TCP connections, which is probably the primary intent of that policy, but we're not actually filtering out all the irrelevant traffic. Someone can still flood our machine with TCP packets that it didn't ask for. Questions? Policy. Okay, so we have a kind of working policy, but this kind of insufficientness here is one reason why we're going to want to think about a stateful firewall, and why typically in practice people, if they have the resources, will try to deploy a stateful firewall instead of this strategy. This is going to use this to bring up another issue, that we're doing something different than routing, and that we're looking at these extra fields like the TCP flags. And the TCP flags, you know, we might say, oh, they're just a little bit further in the packet. But a little bit further in the packet is kind of actually more problematic than it seems, because if we remember how IP works, we have our IP header and our data for IP. And when this gets too big, we can do fragmentation. So we can transform this into an IP header and the first part of the data, an IP header and the second part of the data, an IP header and the third part of the data. And for our filtering, we want to find the flags. And the TCP flags might be here. So how is our firewall supposed to deal with that and do this packet filtering rule properly? And the answer that NetFilter has, because I can write these rules with NetFilter, is that they reassemble the fragments, that they have to do the extra work of reassembling it, or else you can't implement the rule. An alternate policy you might have is you might just disallow these really small fragments because they're probably not there for a good reason. But in general, we have this problem that because we're not doing just things at just IP, we have to worry about things that routers don't. With routers, well, we never look at anything beyond these IP headers, so this fragmentation was invisible to us. Now it is not, because we are dealing with things inside the data part of IP, which IP was designed not to have routers do. But our firewalls, you know, aren't strictly an IP layer thing. So I can, for example, like send my TCP fragment where we can't actually figure out that this is a SYN packet until we reassemble these three fragments, at least the first two. And there's another fun thing, which is another reason we want to do this fragment reassembly, which is I can send two different versions of the fragments. So here, I sent the first part, and I have two versions of the second fragment, one of which has a TTL of 3, the other of which has a TTL of 64. So I've even chosen which one will probably make it to the final machine. And if we're a firewall, we want to figure out what to do about this fragmented packet, even though there's two versions of it. So the idea of reassembling it kind of solves this problem. We choose one of the versions, and that's what we're going to send on. But if we didn't do that, if like we tried to like identify the fragment in flight, we could easily get confused here. And if we weren't careful and just sending the fragments on after, you know, filtering them, seeing, oh, this is where the TCP flags would be, let's check it, we could get confused. The other issue that came up is I wrote this particular rule to match TCP flags, and you know, I had to be careful to check that the flags ended with this mask were the SYN flag, because you know, there's a lot of things I could have missed. And some of these like aren't really defined. Like what happens if I set one of the reserved bits in the TCP header to 1? That's probably gonna vary. And the TCP standard doesn't define what a lot of these combinations actually mean, right? So because I'm not using the same TCP implementation as the end host, I don't know the host that's receiving this will interpret this as a connection request. I'm just guessing because I don't know how it handles all these corner cases, right? I think SYN or the urgent flag, right? That's a way you can set up a TCP packet. I don't think it's defined whether that's a valid connection request. And also, if the TCP standard adds things, right, we're probably going to mishandle them in our firewall rules because we didn't think of that. And this is probably why when we talked about ECN, I said ECN like didn't work on a lot of networks. A lot of networks filtered it out. This is probably why that happened, because it was the TCP flags. They were looking at the TCP flags. They didn't think about what if someone adds these features to TCP. They don't handle them. Suddenly, their connections don't work. And so this is like kind of inherently a problem with this firewall idea, is that our firewall, in addition to like going into parts of the packet that we aren't supposed to be responsible for interpreting. You know, we might interpret them differently than the intended end host. And usually we think of like TCP, it's end to end, right? What matters is what each of the end hosts does, but firewalls violate that rule, you know, and therefore can break things that are supposed to work because all the stuff in the middle, so far we said, oh, doesn't interfere with our connection. We have the end-to-end principle where all the work was being done at the end, firewalls violate this. And I talked about this sort of ambiguity. This gets much worse when we talk about doing higher level filtering. So let's say I want to make a firewall rule that disallows this. And there's a huge number of problems with trying to do that. And I say, we'll say, although there's a huge number of problems, there are firewalls that do this. But there are a huge number of problems with trying to do this. So one thing we could do is we could look at the data and see if it contains /malicious in our TCP packets. But there's a huge number of refinements we're going to want to make if we actually want to make this an effective rule against someone making this presumably very bad HTTP request. So one issue is that it could be split across multiple TCP packets. So to handle that, we're going to need to do something stateful, akin to fragment reassembly, to like assemble the HTTP request together. We could have a file that contains /malicious just innocently. I'm uploading a 6 GB disk image. Maybe those bytes are in there by accident, or you know, it's not part of the request. Do we actually want to filter that, or do you want to break this file upload for no apparent reason? And might be, you know, this case might be obvious, but if we have like 1,000 of these rules, that's going to be problematic. Also, there's probably other creative ways I can write my GET request. And in order for this filtering to be effective, we need to handle all of them. You know, if I require it to be GET space, maybe GET space 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 works. Now, you know, that's not how the request is supposed to look. HTTP RFC says don't do that, but the web server might handle it fine. Questions? Yes. And so, does anyone have an idea what would be a good way of doing this type of filtering? We've talked about something that would be very helpful for doing this type of filtering already. And that is the way that people mostly do it. Because this type of filtering is actually very common. And there's a technology that enables it that we've talked about when we talked about HTTP. So instead of doing this in a packet filter, right, where we're saying, oh, I'm going to run a packet filter, we can instead set up a reverse proxy and have it replace our web server. And this idea is commonly called a web application firewall. And this works a lot better because the HTTP reverse proxies, they don't get packets, they get HTTP requests. And they forward the whole HTTP request and the whole HTTP response. So they're actually dealing with the right unit where they know what the path is. And also they can normalize the path. So they can, you know, decide that if I see a request like this, they'll make a decision about, do I resend that with one space or do I just reject it? Versus our firewalls, probably not going to really have that luxury. So these web application firewalls are doing something similar to packet filtering, but instead of doing it on IP packets, we do it on HTTP requests and responses. But it's the same idea. We're going to have rules set up that match the specific requests and responses. You know, and they're going to look at particular fields in those requests and responses. And that's how it's going to work. So just like we do the firewall rules at the IP packet level, which is most common, we can apply the same idea to a higher level. And that's generally going to work better than trying to manipulate our firewall that works with IP packets to handle it. Not that, even though there are real firewalls that work with IP packets that will implement these kinds of rules with a lot of effort. But to give an example of a web application firewall rule, Mod Security is an Apache web server plugin that implements a web application firewall. And here's an example of a rule for it, where we say, I want to match the response body for this pattern that is supposed to represent some malicious software that if we see it responding on our web server, something is very bad. And saying to block and log it in that case. Or we can have some similar matching on our requests. So if we get a request for this 5C, this is a dot for like /.. That usually indicates someone's trying to access files they're not supposed to. This, in this case, would block such requests if it was in the headers or the URI. Or some certain other places. Questions on our web application firewalls. Okay, so we're going to move on from this design here, and you know, we have this disappointing. Another disappointing thing about this approach was, in addition to not, you know, maybe not consistently identifying what's actually a TCP connection request, we had this issue that we were only filtering out TCP connection requests. There's all this other TCP traffic that we just allowed as is. And that kind of violated our intended policy that this machine doesn't receive all these extra packets. It only receives packets that it solicited by making a connection outside. In order to fix that, we're going to need a stateful firewall. And the kind of state we need to implement that policy, that I connect to an outside server, I receive responses back, and that's all I get, that is the most common type of stateful firewall. So the state we're going to track is going to be a list of connections. So we're going to keep track of all the connections that are going through our firewall, and this is going to allow us to implement the policy that you make a connection, you get all the packets for that connection, and they go through the firewall, but packets that aren't part of a connection you made don't go through. And that's very commonly a type of policy we want. So this state tracking is by far the most common we'll see in firewalls. And we also want to extend this state tracking to other types of protocols besides TCP, that we're going to have a notion of a connection over UDP, because we want UDP-based protocols like HTTP3 or DNS to work. We're going to have a notion of a connection over ICMP because we want the ping command, which sends ICMP echo requests, to work. So our list of connections is going to be broader than just a list of TCP connections, and it's going to allow us to implement this rule that I can solicit traffic from the outside and get it, but you know, I don't get unsolicited traffic. So that's what we'll talk about next time. So we'll finish up talking about firewalls next time and probably start talking about encapsulation or